This is an ABC podcast.
Hello there. Welcome to the Religion and Ethics Report. It's Andrew West here on RN and podcast. As Afghans try to flee their country, could their future lie in special safe zones with help from the West?
Equally important that protection be provided from the Taliban. So we assume that from today, the Taliban will control the country's airport. There may well be a need to implement a no-fly zone, as well as providing military support and weaponry to this area.
That's ahead on the show. And later in the program, why protests continue to roil the Palestinian territories. As you've been hearing, it was literally 1 minute to midnight when the last American plane left Afghanistan this week. The Taliban fired their guns in celebration. They now control the country. So what's the fate of Afghans who still need to leave? Australia's airlifted about 4,000 people under pressure to take 20,000 refugees. But that is a drop in the ocean if the latest estimate from the UN High Commission for Refugees is correct. Dr. Tazreena Sajjad is a refugee and migration expert at the School of International Service at the American University. She joined me from Washington.
It's still early days just because the situation on the ground is unfolding. Now, the UN estimate is about 500,000. Again, that could be a conservative estimate. A lot will depend on how many people are actually able to cross the borders. The vast majority of that 500,000 will not be crossing through formal evacuation procedures and certainly will not be leaving through chartered flights. So there'll be a lot of irregular movement of people into neighboring countries. And there'll be perhaps a larger number who will continue to be displaced internally inside Afghanistan.
Internally displaced peoples. We have seen this tragedy across the Middle East. We've seen it particularly in Syria. How many people do we think could actually be still within the borders of Afghanistan, but forced out of their homes, forced out of their villages?
I would be hesitant to offer you an estimate at this point in time. What I will say is, up until before this current crisis that's been unfolding, Afghanistan has had, at least officially speaking, 3.5 million internally displaced people. And these Afghans displaced as a result of political violence, as a result of the ongoing climate crisis, together with unstable government structures, unemployment opportunities, as well as ongoing violence. So there's a lot of complex factors that have been driving people away from their homes. And we already had a significant number of IDPs or internally displaced people in Afghanistan. Given the current situation where people are obviously concerned about their future in terms of what kind of political configuration the Taliban administration will actually look like, together with people who have already moved from their homes in the anticipation that they might be able to leave Afghanistan, we are still probably looking at several million. And again, this is just an estimate at this point, and I would definitely look to official numbers, that calculation, as and when it comes out.
Tazreena, you've done some very deep research in this area. We can certainly look to some official numbers. Let's look to recent history as well. Where have Afghan refugees gone in the recent past?
Afghanistan is a country that has gone through periods of great political turbulence. And in the last 40 years, Afghanistan has not known a state of constant and consistent peace, which means in the last 40 years, many, many, many Afghans have been displaced. In the 1980s, for instance, there were at least 5 million official Afghans who were displaced from Afghanistan. That is, they were forced to leave and they could cross the borders. And the 5 million Afghans actually ended up in Pakistan and Iran. These have been the largest countries in terms of taking in Afghan refugees.
Does it break down by ethnicity or nationality? Do we see Hazaras being Shia going to Iran and Pashtuns going to Pakistan? Is it that simple?
It's not that simple. It never is. There may be, obviously, certain instances where, you know, people move as a result of complex reasons, and family ties, social connections, and sense of safety and security may create a network, an informal network that makes people feel safer to move into certain contexts where they feel that there's a cohesive unit that might be supportive. But Afghans are actually a people of various different ethnicities, of different religious groups. We often forget that Afghans are overwhelmingly Muslims, but we also have small percentages of Afghan Sikhs, Afghan Hindus, and Afghan Christians. And so we have to take that into consideration as well. People flee where they can flee. And so it's not a clear dividing line in terms of what we, in a very simple way, look in terms of a Shia-Sunni divide.
We're going to hear a lot. We are already hearing a lot about the pressure, in inverted commas, that will come on Western countries to take Afghan refugees. The reality is a lot different, though. Afghan refugees are going to flee on foot. That's only going to take them so far.
We tend to be Eurocentric or Western-centric in our worldview. We think the vast majority of people from any given context are moving either to the United States or to the European continent or to Australia. But that has never the case. That has never been the case. And it's certainly not the case with regard to Afghan refugees. Prior to this crisis, for instance, Pakistan was already hosting over 1.4 million registered refugees, Afghan refugees, for the last 40 years. And they also had a large number of unregistered Afghan refugees who were classified as irregular migrants. And then, of course, in the context of Iran, Iran has had close to about 1 million Afghan registered refugees, and again, at least about 2 million undocumented Afghans in the country. You know, when you actually tally the numbers in terms of the percentage of people who actually need sanctuary or the percentage of people who are actually able to leave a country across an international border, a very small percentage of Afghans have ended up in any of the Western contexts, even though there is a hysteria associated with this idea that there's a huge influx and the quote unquote wave is coming and it will be a tsunami of people or something that cannot be managed, cannot be controlled, and that will certainly be extremely destructive for the political stability of any given context in the West.
I wonder if there is not a geopolitical element to this, in that Pakistan already, as you say, has 1.4 million Afghan refugees and displaced people in its borders. If Pakistan doesn't want to absorb or thinks it cannot absorb any more Afghan refugees, could this actually convince Pakistan to put some sort of political pressure on the new Taliban government not to have a human rights situation that causes refugee flows?
First of all, the 1.4 million or 1.5 million Afghan refugees in Pakistan, that's the registered number, right? They're registered with the United Nations High Commission for Refugees. There's a larger number, perhaps, of Afghan refugees. And Pakistan also is host to other asylum seekers and refugees as well, but largely it's Afghan. And that's unregistered. So they live as irregular migrants. And so they'd have to deal with different levels of obstructions and different kinds of challenges because they are not authorized and they're not recognized in terms of their rights to protection, so on and so forth. But the extent to which Pakistan will be successful in and want to actually pressurize and negotiate with the Taliban, and that will end up in a human rights catastrophe in Afghanistan being averted, well, I think it's early days to make that kind of claim, because the Taliban is a strategic force. It's a complex actor. It has its own geopolitical interests. So till the dust settles, until we know what that political configuration is going to look like, people will still be fleeing for a while, or people will still be anxious and be displaced. And the extent to which Pakistan can negotiate unilaterally with the Taliban to resolve this, I think, is perhaps a little naive on our part to sort of assume.
When Afghans do manage to cross borders, where are they resettled? Are we talking about camps, or do people go into general populations? Are there special zones? Or
In any given refugee situation, there's only a small percentage, particularly if you talk about any country in the global south, where people are able to actually have access to documentation, that is passport and a visa, that they're able to actually have the money to be able to fly using an airlines to get to the destination of their choice. A vast majority of people have to travel irregularly. So you mentioned moving on foot or through other forms of irregular channels. And certainly there's been a lot of coverage in terms of taking very unsafe boats and dinghies, as in the case with regard to the Mediterranean. Refugees may live in camps in certain places, in certain kinds of, you know, villages along the borders that are largely dominated by refugee populations, but many of them also live as irregular migrants in city centers. So, for instance, in the case of Iran, there are about between 700,000 and 800,000 that are registered, and 96% of them actually live in the cities and towns and villages side by side with the Iranian host community, and about 4% live in settlements managed by UNHCR's main government counterpart within the Iranian government.
Dr. Tazarina Sajjad of the School of International Service at the American University in Washington, and this is the Religion and Ethics Report. So, with the UN predicting that 500,000 Afghans could try to flee, is one possible answer a Kurdish-style solution? Could refugees establish safe autonomous zones in border regions and achieve the sort of success that the Kurds have had in northern Iraq? Thomas McGee was an advisor with the UN High Commissioner for Refugees, and he worked with the Kurds. He's now with the Peter McMullen Centre on Statelessness at Melbourne University. Thomas, welcome. Are there any parallels between the plight of Afghans today and the Kurds about 30 years ago?
Speaking to a lot of Kurdish people, they see the parallels and are expressing solidarity with the people of Afghanistan, considering that many feel they've gone through similar experiences. And I think there's also a lot of unknowns relating to the context in Afghanistan at the moment. Although I'm not an Afghanistan expert, I think there's the two key questions that we maybe need to wait on are to what extent the resistance front of Afghanistan is well positioned to organize themselves for self-rule, but equally the response of the international community. And obviously those things are quite linked.
I'm also thinking, though, Thomas, of even people in Afghanistan who aren't minorities, even those who are part of, well, they're not a majority, but the largest group, the Pashtuns. Could there be a parallel between their maybe seeking refuge in a kind of autonomous zone? Because didn't some Iraqis and some Syrians who weren't Kurdish also find some refuge in Kurdish autonomous zones?
Yes, it's true, particularly in the recent Syrian context. So we've seen that a lot of communities, be it Christian communities, other minority communities like the Yazidis, have sought sanctuary in the Kurdish areas. But equally, members of the demographic majority, there's now a strong alliance that has emerged between Kurds and Arabs in the north and northeast of Syria. So what initially began as a project with a strong Kurdish ethnic identity has expanded, and even the name has changed. So it's now referred to as the Syrian Democratic Project rather than having a strong separate Kurdish identity, and is intended to represent all factions within society.
So this is fascinating, Thomas. There is a potential. Were similar safe autonomous zones established in parts of Afghanistan for these to be non-sectarian?
Yeah, I believe so. And one of the key features of the Kurdish-led self-rule project, or the autonomous project, we can call it, in Syria, it's been led through very strong grassroots, bottom-up governance structures. So these essentially operate around the smallest level of governance. So it can be a commune. They use this term commune for a single street or a village. And that is supposed to just reflect the local interests, whatever they might be. So each commune defines its identity, its priorities and interests. So they need not all subscribe to the same rubric.
What's kept violence at bay within these autonomous Kurdish zones?
There have been a lot of external threats on the Kurdish zones. The main factor that's resisting the violence is, I would say, the well-organized formation of the security forces. So not only the offensive military, but they've developed a whole host of quite sophisticated local security forces. So there's, in addition to the women's protection units, there are local groups that, again, patrol their local area. So there's Christian militias that are patrolling along the Christian inhabited areas that protect the churches, and likewise in other areas. So I think that's one of the main structures that's been helpful in avoiding violence.
If an autonomous zone was set up in parts of Afghanistan, what factors do you need there? I'm thinking geography, or do you need to be close to an international border? I mean, what worked in Kurdish zones?
I would say I think there's a number of factors. The enclave really needs to be quite self-contained and have defined borders somehow or other. And generally, it's been helpful that there's a relatively cohesive population. But as you say, access to international borders is really, really key, or at least some route for importing resources. However self-sustaining the enclave or the project might try to be. So I guess there's a lesson learned we've seen from the Kurdistan region of Iraq. Even though it shares three international borders with Syria, with Turkey and Iran, we've seen moments where those countries have boycotted it in response to the independence referendum in 2017. They cut the borders and it had a really detrimental impact, just proving how important it is to have these strong links. And then the terrain is also important. So as far as I know, in Afghanistan, the region that we're really generally looking at is the Panjshir province, which to my knowledge is an enclave in the interior of the country. So that would be quite difficult, I would imagine, to smuggle in resources that are needed, or it might otherwise require airlifts in, potentially from the international community.
What sort of protections does the international community need to provide to these autonomous zones, as they've done with the Kurds and conceivably could do with some Afghans seeking refuge? I mean, how does the international community protect these people?
Again, I think it's multiple. So humanitarian assistance is really important, and that should always be irrespective of whatever the political project is. So the UN and NGOs have to negotiate continued access. But in addition to that, it's actually equally important that protection be provided from the Taliban. So we assume that from today, effectively, the Taliban will control the country's airport. There may well be a need to implement a no-fly zone, as well as providing military support and weaponry to this area. And then ultimately, and perhaps the most important, I would suggest, is in the longer term, the international community using its leverage to attempt to broker some kind of more sustainable coexistence framework with the Taliban. We've seen this in Iraq, where an arrangement has been arrived upon between the central authorities in Baghdad and the region. Although that said, such an arrangement still hasn't happened in Syria. So I think that would be key, however challenging it might be.
As impossible as it might sound, is it feasible that these sort of quasi-state entities could even grow out of refugee camps? Could refugee camps ever get to the point where they're sufficiently well-established, well-serviced, schools, power, water, businesses, to actually become the seed of a quasi-state entity?
It's a very interesting question. And having worked with a lot of displaced people, they're often very incredibly resourceful and do, of their own accord, often set up self-governing structures. So it's certainly not impossible to build governance in displacement contexts. We've seen this elsewhere. I'm thinking of Syria in particular, where the UN and international community is scarcely on the ground. But what I would say is it's going to be incredibly difficult if there is conflict ongoing, which would be distracting from these efforts. So I would say it's not being displaced that is the deciding factor, but rather whether or not the international community can do something to alleviate the potential threats from the Taliban towards these possible areas. So I think that's really the baseline.
Very good to talk to you. Thomas McGee, he's a former advisor with the UNHCR. He's now with the Peter McMullen Centre on Statelessness at the University of Melbourne. Thank you for joining us on the program, Thomas.
Thank you, Andrew.
And you're with Andrew West. Now, if you go to the ABC Religion and Ethics portal where you find the articles, there's a brilliant piece by former Race Discrimination Commissioner Tim Soutphommasane and Professor Mark Steers about the way the COVID responses have undermined fundamental human rights and why people who call themselves progressives haven't actually spoken up. That's at the ABC Religion and Ethics portal. The Palestinian West Bank is roiling with protest, but this time the target is not the Israeli government. In late June, Palestinian police in Ramallah killed a popular Palestinian activist, Nizar Beinat. But the Palestinians are now back on the streets and they're invoking the cause of a new Arab Spring. Iris Makler reports from Ramallah.
For the past 2 months, Palestinians in the West Bank have been taking to the street in their thousands to protest against the Palestinian Authority. They've been galvanised by the arrest and killing of activist Nizar Beinat by Palestinian security forces in June. Lawyer and activist Diala Ayesh was a personal friend of Beinat's. She's joined the protest movement.
We need transparency, justice, lack of corruption, and we want the Palestinian Authority to allow resistance. We want to protest. We want to fight.
They're using the same slogans that were used at the beginning of the Arab Spring, which is the people want to bring down the regime.
Journalist Khaled Abu Tomei is an Israeli Arab and a critic of the Palestinian Authority.
I've been covering Palestinian issues for 40 years now. I haven't seen anything like that in the last 30 years of the history of the Palestinian Authority. They want a Palestinian spring.
Protesters chant, "Leave, leave, leave." Many want to replace Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas. He's held power since 2005 and cancelled the first Palestinian elections this past May. Diala Ayesh says she wants to go further and to disband the Palestinian Authority, the PA, altogether.
We do not want the PA to be in charge of us. We want them out of our lives.
At some protests, Palestinian police protected by riot shields threw stun grenades. At others, social media video has emerged of police violence from people inside the crowds dressed as protesters. Diala alleges police pushed and beat her. She says that male officers also touched her sexually.
This was a Palestinian security member who was dressed in his official uniform, harassing me sexually. That was the thing that hurt most. And for 2 days, I needed therapy. Good.
In Ramallah, Palestinians say they're shocked by how removed their leadership appears to be from them. Journalist Khaled Abu Tomei argues that Palestinian leaders are more worried about reactions in the US and Europe than on the Palestinian street. And that, he says, boils down to money.
These are the largest funders of the Palestinian Authority. Money buys you loyalty, and money keeps you in power. And for President Abbas, who's now 86 years old and in his 16th year of a four-year term in office, I mean, the name of the game is survival. He's very sensitive to what the Europeans say, what the Americans say. And as long as they are happy with him and satisfied with him, the Palestinian people can just wait.
Palestinian media reports that 14 officers involved in the killing of Nizar Beinat have been arrested. It's understood they're being held in a jail in Jericho, though little more is known. Binat's family, for example, say they've never been called to testify and have never even been approached by investigators. Khaled Abu Tome again.
They said there was an investigation. The head of the investigation team, the Minister of Justice, Mohammad Shalaldeh, he says, we presented our findings to the Prime Minister without elaborating. I mean, what are the findings? Who's guilty? Who ordered the arrest? Who are the people who participated? And why did they go there to arrest him? There are many question marks. And Palestinians are not getting answers.
More protests last weekend led to more arrests. This time it was Ramallah's middle class, including well-known poets, academics, artists and writers, who ended up in overcrowded Palestinian jails during a fourth wave of COVID-19.
Release the detainees and stop political arrests.
This woman's husband was among the detainees. She condemned the arrests in a video where her face was visible, though she didn't publicise her name.
I'm really concerned on the well-being of my husband. I do not know what to tell my three kids. I lied to them yesterday. I told them that their father is at work. My kids are still traumatized from the first assault that targeted us as a family last month. Well, this is definitely not the state we are struggling for.
The arrest of prominent Palestinians has led to international condemnation, including from progressive US politicians like Palestinian-American Congresswoman Rashida Tlaib. What started in response to the killing of an activist has grown into a protest movement. But it's challenging a president who has the support of his political and security apparatus, and also of the international community, for the moment at least.
Iris Mackler reporting there from Ramallah. Next week, a special program to mark the 20th anniversary of the 9/11 terrorist attacks. You're going to hear a range of voices, including the eminent Harvard political scientist Jocelyn Cesari. She's written extensively about the impact that 9/11 had on the Islamic world, the West, and interreligious cooperation.
Since 9/11, the goal is to maintain the security of the US internationally and also to justify any kind of aggression or aggressive posture internationally, also as a way to promote the values of American politics and political system. So they have not done this kind of introspection or internal reassessment, not at all at the political level. The Americans have done it. And that's, I think, also part of the trauma. They are not confident as they used to be in the institutions and values that the US leaders are claiming outside. And, you know, all the data shows that the trust in American institutions is the lowest in history. And it feeds all the sides. It feeds the people who will vote for Trump, but it also feeds the feeling of uneasiness of the young people, the same who will be part of the Black Lives Movement.
That's next week's special on the 20th anniversary of 9/11. But for now, that's the program for this week. You can follow us at the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts. And please leave us a review at iTunes or any of those platforms. Thanks to Hong Jiang, Wayne Ewan and Anne-Marie de Bettencourt. I'm Andrew West. The Religion and Ethics Report is back next week.